as a countermeasure against the fatal diseases and health-destroying effects of their highly incomplete attitudes towards nourishment and their harmful habits of life, which cause an ocean of illness. There has been developed a very extensive medical science with large hospitals, serum institutes, operating theaters, medical wards, convalescent homes, nursing homes, and so on. This medical science fought night and day in a state of high mental tension in order to stamp out all suffering. But it was a hopeless fight. It was like fighting with a many-headed monster that had the ability to grow a new head where an old one had been removed. These heads showed themselves in the form of an unnatural and premature decrepitude, unnatural calcification and the formation of stones in the organism, digestive problems, metabolic disorders, paralysis, the formation of tumors, and so forth. One fought with the monster. Energetic researchers all over the world worked to find ways of killing the monster, that is, means of preventing new heads growing in place of the old. But the materialistic attitude in which one reckoned only with the physical side of the being, and to a certain degree even denied or ignored the idea of its soul and spirit, kept the gaze of science away from that area where the monster was vulnerable and could be hit in the heart. Since science did not want to and could not focus on this, the monster's only vulnerable place, one could not possibly kill it. This demonic being continued to undermine and destroy the health and well-being of mankind. In spite of persistent work night and day on the part of doctors and of science, in spite of huge institutions for research and vivisection, in spite of vaccines, powders and pills, not a single hospital became superfluous. On the contrary, one had to extend every hospital and build many new ones. The monster still had an immeasurable capacity for surviving. The human being of the future again shivers as he looks back at this hopeless struggle of the people of today. In the kingdom of the future, with its totally perfect world culture, one has long since discovered the monster's only vulnerable spot, that is its heart or core of life, and here found this area to be identical with the innermost causal source of not only all illnesses but also of all sufferings and unhappy fates that could possibly arise. But it is not so remarkable that, with a purely materialistic attitude, one could not find this monster's core of life, because it does not exist at all on the material or physical plane. It lies well hidden within the being's fate element, which in turn lies within the being's superconsciousness beyond the physical organism. It is enlivened by the being's own immortal eye. And as long as the eye enlivens the monster's core of life, it cannot be killed by other beings, regardless of how competent they may be as scientific specialists. Indeed, not even a Christ could kill the monster in the beings he helped. This was why he said to them the well-known words, "Your faith has saved you." The secret is thus that as long as the eye, even if unconsciously, nourishes the monster, new heads will continue to grow where the old ones are removed, and the being goes on living in the areas of illness and unhappy fates, goes on creating a demon in its area of life. This demon is given life exclusively through the being's use of poisonous and deadly thought substances. When a being thinks, a force goes from the superconsciousness of the eye into the night consciousness of its subconsciousness. Here this force becomes formed as a mental image and is then transmitted to the day consciousness of the subconsciousness, which, when the being is not asleep, has its domicile in the physical brain. Here the thought goes on to become desire or will and gives rise to manifestation and creation in the material world. But at the same time as this thought power vibrates into the physical brain and nerve system, it vibrates through the different areas of the physical body such as the blood, the musculature, the skeleton, and the glands, and here constitutes a functioning power. This power constitutes the being's life force. It promotes, as previously mentioned, the being's thought function. But with the promotion of this function it can be weakened as a life force. This weakening can even be so prominent that the above mentioned power is no longer a life force but a death force. The weakening is in turn caused by the kinds of thought or thought substance the being uses, since these pass through his brain or nerve system and likewise vibrate in his blood and other parts of the physical organism. Some kinds of thoughts can in fact be pure poison and undermine the life force, whereby the nerves, blood and other parts of the physical organism are undermined. These cannot in fact exist without a permanent supply of healthy psychic power. For the terrestrial human being, the kinds of thought belonging to the killing principle, such as thoughts of hatred, anger and bitterness, are poisonous. They destroy not only their originator's good relationship to his surroundings and fellow beings, but they also destroy the being's original immunity to diseases and weaknesses in his own organism. Disease in the organism as well as an unhappy relation to one's surroundings has thus its absolute first cause here in the being's region of consciousness in the form of thought. Incorrect use of thought and the ensuing incorrect use of the will and incorrect creation thus constitute the one and only true cause of its originator's unhappy fate, whether it expresses itself as war with his fellow beings or as disease in the organism or the mind. In this way, every being himself thus becomes the innermost cause of his unhappiness or suffering. By supplying his life force with deadly kinds of thoughts, the being, without knowing it, thus becomes his own deadly enemy. It is not so strange that the perfect human being of the future will shudder when looking back at the ordinary human being of today who, in total ignorance, sabotages and undermines his normal experience of life and at the same time hates and persecutes his neighbor in the blind belief that it is this neighbor who is his life's most bitter enemy, persecutor and saboteur. Chapter 6, The Present Modern Culture's Unfinished Sides. Number 3, Armageddon. A society of beings that gives life to a multi-headed life, a destroying being in its own mentality, must become a world of darkness, that is a matter of course. But since the beings at the same time believe it is their neighbors who give life and force to the undermining of their own happiness and well-being, and therefore have designs on his life, the entire life area of these beings becomes, so to speak, a world of demons. Everyone is at war with everyone else. He believes that he can thereby save himself from darkness and create that peaceful existence for which those poor beings in their innermost selves begin to long. They do not understand at all that what they do to their neighbor they do to themselves. They firmly believe that their salvation is the development of the ability to murder and mutilate, tie and bind their neighbor. They have no idea that for each sabotage of their neighbor's life and well-being that they have carried out, they have created a new head on the gnawing and life-destroying animal being in their own psychic interior. They thus give the monster they want to master life and power through their murderous and inhumane thoughts, their hatred and persecution of their neighbor. It follows from this culminating ignorance and superstition that a society of these beings cannot possibly build up a perfect culture of peace. We then also see this culture of demons as a complete contrast to the world culture of the finished human beings or the kingdom of heaven. For the human being of the future who is accustomed to living in a world culture, or that peaceful goodwill which has been promised the people of the earth and in which everyone loves everyone else, it can well be that he, with shivers or a certain feeling of goose pimples, looks back thousands of years and finds this contrast to the kingdom of heaven in our present highly praised modern culture. He sees that in this culture millions of people die of starvation, in need and misery, while other groups of people live in abundance or in excessive possession of physical or material wealth. Some people live in luxurious palaces with a staff of servants that goes with them. They are sometimes too distinguished to dress and undress themselves. Other people suffer a tramp-like existence in the slum quarters of the big cities in ruins, sheds and boxes, or in whatever other discarded rubbish that can give a little shelter from the weather and the wind. It is obvious for the human being of the future that no particular neighborly love exists in this culture's administration of the material necessities of life. The finished or completed human being becomes witness to even less understanding of the principle of neighborly love when he sees that one, in the same culture, sees it as one's foremost and most important duty to compel all young men to be trained in warfare, to be trained in the use of the modern murder machines by which one can multiply the ability to wipe out and destroy the life, possessions and culture of one's neighbor. This warlike attitude leaves deep tracks. Thousands upon thousands of children have lost their parents through the bloodbaths of the wars and are left at random to their own devices. Thousands upon thousands of parents look for their children who have disappeared during the same bloodbaths. Out of this Armageddon came millions upon millions of invalids who can experience life only with the help of artificial limbs, artificial hands, arms and legs. Nevertheless, one praises this civilized milieu as the field of glory. The gods of Valhalla and their blood-stained paradise are still praised and worshipped in wide areas of the prevailing culture we call Christianity. But within this Christianity, one has not only developed the most ingenious murder weapons and means of destruction with which one can totally wipe out other nations, states and peoples and their culture, one has also here a tailor-made murder system with which one believes one can promote justice within the state or nation itself. Here one murders or executes people with rifles, guillotines, electric chairs and so on in the name of the state or in the name of the law, and in addition also in the name of him who said to his disciples, "Put up again thy sword into its place, for all they that take the sword shall perish with the sword." Indeed, our present culture cannot avoid revealing vast areas of unfinished nature or primitiveness and superstition to him for whom it had become daily, natural behavior rather to be crucified himself than to want to have others suffer. From his kingdom, which is not yet of this world, one cannot avoid, when looking back upon today's culture, looking into a world of Armageddon, a worshipping of Valhalla and its gods. In addition to this, there has arisen intensified worship of an infinite number of golden calves. The great majority of beings are hoping for a Croesus-type existence and look with contempt on the poor and stable that in their Christmas gospel is referred to as the abode for him who was the way towards light. For this reason Armageddon had to come to Jerusalem. And for this reason Armageddon had to come upon every culture where upbringing, morality and concepts of honor are based on gold instead of on neighborly love, or on the principle rather to take than to give. To the extent that one lacks the ability rather to give than to take, to that same extent will one's behavior towards one's neighbor be based on primitiveness and superstition. And there one treads very cheerfully where angels fear to tread. Chapter 7, Judge Not. The great view of the future portrayed above does not constitute the present ordinary terrestrial human being's view of his culture and behavior. It is a retrospect from the high pinnacles of a fully developed mankind. It is the organically, cosmically initiated being's view of terrestrial mankind's situation today. It is from this level of consciousness that the World Redeemer views the same situation. It is in relation to his kingdom and to what is God's goal or life's purpose for the human being that the present world culture appears as it does. But those beings whose consciousness is so highly developed or completely created in God's image that they live in the finished or complete human kingdom are highly intellectual and loving judges. They are therefore allowed to see existence and life from God's own great point of view and thereby acquire the same attitude to life and existence as the Godhead. It is this that Christ expresses when he says, "I and the Father, we are one." From this high viewpoint one can see that one cannot blame this unfinished world culture on any terrestrial human being of today whatsoever. The unfinished human being does not have the experience of the road to love that makes it possible in all situations to see this road as the only real and infallible one towards the light. He must therefore here and there to a greater or lesser extent wander from this road and thereby come to experience the impassibility, the morasses and muddy terrains that here obstruct the road towards the light for him who does not want to walk the road of love. But it is through derailments that the road of love is delineated and becomes a fact. People cannot today act according to experiences that they have not had but will have only later. Where they have not had any real experiences or facts, they cannot have the right knowledge. And where they do not have the right knowledge, they have to manifest primitiveness and superstition. But primitiveness and superstition are in turn the superfluous parts that God has not yet chiseled away from the stone or marble out of which he forms his great work of art, man in his image. And who dares judge an artist's work as long as he has not yet freed it from that part of the stone or marble block not belonging to the work of art? It is not the superfluous parts of the stone or marble that the artist cuts away and removes, but that part of the block that he carefully leaves behind that becomes the work of art. In the same way, it is neither primitiveness nor superstition, nor the wrong actions towards our neighbor to which these give rise, that God allows to remain behind us that which lasts, but the noble, The loving aspects of his character and behavior become God's work of art, become the human being in God's image after his likeness. The present terrestrial human being can therefore, by comparing his own culture and behavior with God's finished plan for the human being and his behavior, realize how foolish it is to judge one's neighbor by his unfinished or incorrect actions. These will, however, only mean or indicate that he does not yet constitute the finished sculpted work of art from God's hand. To judge God's unfinished work as finished and so reproach it for faults and defects is not only an exposure of our own naivety or unfinished condition, but it is also a crucifixion of our neighbor and an outrage against the Eternal Father whose Spirit still shines and sparkles upon the waters and in whose halo of rays we are eternally granted life, wisdom and love.